Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The FT.
Welcome back to Banking Weekly with me, Patrick Jenkins. Today we're going to be talking about the latest speech by Richard Lambert, the Director General of the CBI, and the many interesting topics he's raised around banks and their financing the economy. After that, we'll talk about Société Générale and what's happened to their famous rogue trader, I should say infamous rogue trader, Jérôme Kerviel. And finally, the Committee of European Banking Supervisors and what they said last week about the remuneration systems in European banking. To talk about all that, I'm joined this week by Megan Murphy, our investment banking correspondent, and Brooke Masters, our chief regulation correspondent. Welcome, all of you. So let's start with the CBI speech. Megan, you've had a chance to go through this, and I was actually there at the Bloomberg headquarters this morning to hear Richard Lambert talk. He's covered a wide range of topics, but what stood out for you?
Well, as you said, I mean, it was a broad range of topics. And I thought what was most interesting, what I sort of took away, although it's maybe not altogether that surprising, was his real plea to politicians to stop bashing the banks before we go into what is likely to be a very highly contentious earnings season and obviously bonus season as banks start deciding how much money they're going to allocate to distribute in revenues to their employees.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I think it was last week or the week before, Lord Turner, the chairman of the FSA, took a similar tone, really, didn't he? He, you know, literally said, we've got to stop banker bashing.
It is interesting because I feel like we're almost operating on so many different playing fields here in terms of where we're at, in terms of what regulators are saying, what politicians are saying. And I do feel the banks are sort of like, I don't know who to believe. I don't know who to look to now. Adair, exactly as you said, took a very similar line saying, look, we all need to sort of get beyond banker bashing, focus on fixing up our, you know, fixing up the banks that need help and actually moving beyond the sort of turmoil of the past 18 months. It's not productive. These banks have serious issues. The regulators globally are looking at fixing these serious issues, whether that's, you know, forcing them to hold more capital against riskier activities, whether that's clamping down on what was perceived as excessive compensation structures where that delinked risk and reward. But I think the overall message that some key leading figures in the financial sector are trying to get across is we need to close this chapter. We need to move beyond. People are looking at the necessary measures to correct some of these excesses. But this constant headlines of, you know, casino city, billionaire banker boys just isn't getting us there.
Well, Mr. Lambert was very specific about it. He talked about it being irresponsible to talk about casino banking, which is pretty strong criticism, really. And he's also singled out Vince Cable
exactly.
as being irresponsible.
I mean, that to me reads like a pretty firm rebuke specifically to Vince Cable. And I don't know how that's going to be taken. I'm sure Mr. Cable, when we get back to our desk later today, will have had a riposte to a large part of this speech. But I think it is important to put across that while he's saying that, you know, politicians have to, in their respect, accept their share of what regulatory failure went on, he's also saying that banks, you know, a large part of your speech is also saying banks, you do need to heed, you do need to deal with pay sensitively. You do need to stop sort of engaging in these high stakes poaching matches between banks. So he is calling for also some awareness, restraint and awareness. Now, again, as I said, whether or not we're going to get there this earnings season, I think it's anyone's guess still. I don't know, Brooke, what you're hearing among the regulators.
Well, I've been hearing from both regulators and the bankers that, A, since the bank's profits have turned downward, the numbers will probably not be quite as explosive as they were in the past anyway. The other thing I've been hearing, just I had a couple conversations in the last week of people don't want to come here anymore. I mean, I was talking to two big global banks who have M&A bankers who have a choice because they fly all over Europe anyway. They can live anywhere. Several of them have said, look, I'm just not moving to England. I'm happy. I'll stay in Italy. I'll stay in Poland. I'll stay wherever I've been and I'll take your promotion, but I'm not coming here. And it means they're not coming here. They're not paying their nanny here. They're not buying a house here. They're not paying taxes here.
That's a specific point, actually, that Richard Lambert raises in his speech. He talks about the importance of maintaining the UK environment as an attractive one. He actually, in one of his four concluding points, he actually also says specifically that strengthening the financial system as an international centre should be one of the four priorities for going forward, which is obviously very different from the kind of language that's been coming out of Whitehall, including out of George Osborne and Vince Cable, who have both talked about wanting to shrink the relative importance of the city. So I think that's a very valid point. And also, I mean, the other thing in terms of that UK environment, Mr. Lambert cites the example of an unnamed bank that he knows was intending to buy into the UK market and has since stepped back. It's not clear who he was talking about. He could have been talking about NAB. We think that's probably the most likely contender, the Australian bank that had looked at buying some assets, branches from RBS. But it's definitely it's interesting that the head of the CBI is basically talking about the competitiveness of the banking industry and the attractiveness of the city, as well as, you know, the tension with the corporate landscape, which is probably the final point to talk about in terms of this speech. I mean, he's being constructive, really, I think, in terms of trying to resolve this issue of, you know, who is responsible for it. I mean, the title of his speech is "The Dialogue of the Deaf Must End and the Recovery Must Be Financed, But How?" Megan, did you draw any comfort from the ideas that he talked about in the speech?
Well, I think that, you know, you're right in that he is trying to be constructive and offering ways to sort of get beyond this dialogue of the deaf, as he calls it. One of the things also that stood out to me is he says that he's changed his view on the Banking Commission in the UK, which is looking at specifically breaking up large universal banks and separating investment banking from retail banking and other measures to increase competition, particularly on the retail side on the high street. So
he had been against that, and now he's saying he basically is encouraged by.
And I think that was a marked shift in that people are sort of saying, okay, let's move beyond the rhetoric and look at the pragmatic solutions that we can offer. Again, I'm not so sure, though, that as you quite rightly point out, is Whitehall ready to hear these things? Has the politics moved on where, you know, we're going to start looking at, okay, let's divorce ourselves from the overheated rhetoric and move to pragmatic solutions? I don't know. Maybe this is a step in that direction. Maybe some of the other conferences that have been going on about restoring trust, rebuilding trust with the banking sector will move things on. For me, when I go out there and talk to people on the street and other sectors, I just don't feel like we're there yet.
No, I think you're probably right. Well, we'll see what impression this makes in the markets, this speech. I think Mr. Lambert specifically alludes to his hope for some kind of developments in terms of this fund that we know is coming over the next couple of weeks to help small and medium-sized companies. So we'll hopefully in the next couple of weeks be able to talk about that in the podcast. Brooke, I wanted to ask you on our second theme for the day of on rogue trading, Société Générale, and their infamous rogue trader Jérôme Kerviel were in the news big time last week. Mr. Kerviel, who effectively lost the bank 4.9 billion euros, it was going back a couple of years now, but it's all come to court and the trial concluded last week. There was a lot of outrage that Mr. Kerviel was ordered to pay 4.9 billion himself. What was your impression? Was it the right judgment?
It suggests that the court was completely absolving Société Générale of any responsibility for having failed to supervise this guy. And it seems awfully extreme. I don't think you get in a position where you can lose that kind of money without some sort of massive systems failure. And in fact, if you look at what happened to other banks that have had rogue traders, almost all of them have paid large regulatory fines. SocGen did get what was for the French a record fine of 4 million euros, yeah, which, you know, basically in the US you would get for waking up.
But compared to 4.9 billion for an individual, it looks silly.
On the other hand, you know, it is not unheard of to hold somebody responsible, at least in principle, for what's been lost. John Rusnak, who lost $640 million for Allied Irish in the US, was in fact nominally on the hook for the whole thing. Although the way the U.S. handles that is it sort of hangs out there as a number, and then he does a repayment plan. And at least initially he paid $1,000 a month out of his salary, and they were going to revisit it as his employment prospects changed.
Have we seen the last of this? I mean, is there a sort of tale still to be told about what really went on, what sort of system failures were? I mean, do you think everything now that is going to emerge, or there's no big dark looming secrets out there about what went on and Sokgen's role in the loss.
I think there are secrets out there, but I think there has been an agreement in French society to bury them. I almost certainly, people lost their jobs at Sokgen for reasons that they I'm sure thoroughly deserve to lose their jobs. I don't think they're ever going to tell us. The court was our best hope to find out what really had gone wrong. And the court clearly isn't interested in telling it.
No, and it was generally seen. I mean, there was kind of interesting level of outrage in French society about how much of a whitewash for Sokgen this was. I mean, I suppose there's a danger that it actually fuels
the Hutton inquiry.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could seriously fuel outrage. And the thing about rogue traders, in general, when things get that bad and there's that kind of thing, there is something deeply wrong with the systems at the bank. So it's not really good for French society if Sokgen still has big problems.
Well, Mr. Kevielle is appealing against this, isn't he? So, you know, maybe the appeal court will take a different line. But
It'll be interesting. I mean, we haven't had an enormous rogue trader other than Kevielle, really, you know, on this sort of scale in a decade and a half. I mean, there have been smaller incidents, but relatively, there hasn't been this kind of loss. And so
Nick Leeson.
Well, there was Nick Leeson. Well, there was Leeson, and then there were the guys at Daiwa.
Yeah.
And there was another one. They were all in the billion range. And then there was nothing really above 500 million except for Rusnak. And so it suggests that systems did start to get better sort of across the board. To have Sokgen have this kind of failure does make you wonder, is there something else out there?
Well, talk of billions of dollars brings us neatly on to our final topic of pay, which maybe there's not many bankers that take home billions yet, but certainly runs into many millions in the cases of some of the city's most successful bankers. And that's the topic that the Committee of European Banking Supervisors turned their attention to last week. Brooke, again, you were looking at this in quite some detail towards the end of last week. Were you surprised by the direction that it took in the end, that it was actually a lot tougher than some people had been expecting and goes against the FSA's own recommendations in the UK so far?
They basically, whenever they had a choice between taking a slightly more moderate interpretation and a harsher interpretation, SEBS opted for the tougher one. There is, you know, still some rearguard action by particularly the UK, but also surprisingly the Spanish and the French to try and tweak the recommendations. What was interesting is that on things like, you know, there is this in the legislation that passed over the summer, it says you can only get half the bonus in cash. And the FSA and the French wanted to interpret this as half the total bonus in cash. And instead, it turns out only half the upfront part can be in cash. And this creates an enormous tax problem, among other things, which will hit the governments in addition to hitting the bankers, because the bankers basically, they'll get half their bonus in cash and half their bonus in shares, but they'll owe tax on the whole thing, and they're not allowed to sell the shares to pay it.
Yeah.
So the question is, how are they going to pay the Treasury?
That's a clear potential problem. What are the, remind listeners, what are the other main conclusions of the report from last week that change things?
The parts that change, there is this retention period, which is when if you get shares, once they vest and you actually own them, you still have to hold them for another 18 months, which is
hence
a big deal.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. And they did, of course, implement the overall recommendation, which is that up to 60% of the bonuses must be deferred for at least 3 years. And there has to be a clawback so that if either the institution or the banker misbehaves or the investment somehow goes bad, the money will come back.
Which goes a bit further than the FSA had already been practicing, but right, it's along the same lines. Basically.
That part is much less disturbing because it's sort of along with the principles that the Financial Stability Board has put out for global principles.
Yeah.
What's upsetting to everyone is all this stuff is an actual regulation and will be enforced to the letter, while in the U.S. it's really sort of basically guidelines and you know, the Asian centers have shown no interest in restricting pay at all. And so while they sign up to the guidelines, there's no sense that it's actually going to impinge how people pay. And what's really interesting there is for any bank that is, you know, based in the EU, their Asian bankers will be held to the EU standards, while a banker from Citigroup who comes out of New York is not. So it's clearly going to pay. If you happen to work for Lloyd's, probably not Lloyd's because they won't be in Asia, but if you happen to be work for
Standard Chartered,
suddenly Citigroup and JP Morgan are looking really attractive.
Yeah, I mean, that poses, I guess, two big problems for the banks. You've got the banks that are European that are trying to compete in Asia and the US. And, you know, Standard Chartered is very fond of saying that, you know, they just can't compete for people in Asia effectively with local banks because they just can't pay. And then the second issue, I suppose, is how do, let's say, the US, big US banks like Bank of America, Merrill or JP Morgan or Goldman, deal with this in terms of structuring a global pay strategy? Do they pay, if they have, I don't know, co-heads of fixed income, one in New York, one in London, do they pay them differently, or how do they go about this?
It's such a huge problem, and I think that, you know, we don't want to be sound overly sympathetic to the banks, but I really just can't overemphasize how these type of massive changes to compensation structures coming in with banks just not knowing, you know, sort of what the actual rules are going to be, and they seem to be getting tougher in Europe at every turn, does cause these massive problems for banks that are global, that have huge numbers of people in London and in New York and in Hong Kong, and making the system that they don't lose people who say, wait, why is my colleague on Wall Street making, you know, five times more in cash than I'm taking home, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's what we're going to see a lot of trickling out, is these sort of bespoke one-off plans that we've already seen hints of, with whether that's Goldman Sachs giving their London-based partners, you know, additional stock to top them up for the amount they lost in the bonus tax last year, whether it's different banks trying to come up with different structures. But overall, I think the biggest thing we're going to see is just a huge rise in fixed salaries across the board at different levels. So whether you're a director, whether you're an MD, whether or not, whether you're a partner, whatever your official title is, your salary is going to be going way up. And that's really the only way I can see that universal banks with big centers in a lot of different places can make a fair compensation structure. You know, you overlay on top then the thought that we're still going to be, that in the UK in particular, I think people are still very concerned that we'll see a sort of out of left field, you know, another tax specifically on bonuses, that we could see something like that coming through later this year. And it just makes things difficult for them to structure, to deal with, for people to make their tax payments. And you do begin to ask questions, is this doing what we intended to, which is to link risk with reward and to clamp down on the worst successes? Or are we creating a system that's unwieldy, that's, you know, subject, as I increasingly hear from bankers, to legal attack, you know, in different jurisdictions as to whether or not, you know, it's discriminatory, et cetera. So I think we're only at the beginning of this warfare. Rearguard action is already going on.
And I guess one of the biggest issues for the broader market and the broader society is actually, if there is a higher degree of fixed salary being paid in part of structures, what happens when the next downturn comes? Banks are going to be far less able to minimize their fixed costs, and therefore, you know, the next bust could be that much more painful. On that note, let's hear what our US colleagues have to say about the outlook for bank earnings in the US for the rest of the year in our regular feature Stateside. This week we have US business editor Francesco Guerrera on the line. Come in, Francesco.
Thanks, Patrick. This is a big week for the banking sector in the US because we'll see the first of the big banks, JP Morgan, reporting results, third quarter results. There's a lot of anxiety among investors about the results of the big banks in the US. And next week we'll see JP Morgan, and then all the others will be basically in the next 10 days or so. The anxiety is driven by the fact that trading profits at the banks are expected to have fallen sharply, both from the previous quarter and from a year ago. You've got to remember that trading was the mainstay of the bank's recovery in profits after the crisis, partly because there was so much pent-up demand for trading after the quiet days of the crisis that investors piled in and banks were able to make a lot of money, both in terms of volume and the price they charged. Things have been changing rapidly in that respect, partly because the markets have been so uncertain and unsettled in the past few months that banks' trading profits are expected to be falling a lot. And that raises the question of where else big banks like JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and even Citigroup will make their money. That's a big question that people will want answers. The fear is that the fundamental mainstay of the profitability of the banks in the US is coming under threat. If you add on top of that the fact that there's new regulation both in the US and internationally, and the fact that the economy remains at a very, very critical point and certainly growing very sluggishly, you can see why there is an air of pessimism surrounding the banking sector. We will see what JP Morgan says, and particularly what Jamie Dimon, its outspoken chief executive, will have to say about that, and whether he can make a positive case for investors to get back into the banking sector. Back to you, Patrick.
Thanks, Francesco. All that's left for me to do now is to thank my guests this week, Megan Murphy and Brooke Masters, and to thank you for listening. Banking Weekly was produced by Rob Minto. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.